Accession number 4601, Reel 4.
Squadron Leader Sills, Reel 4. Where did you go to after Drigg Road?
After Drigg Road, I went to Rizzlepur on the northwest frontier. Changes were taking place in the RAF at this particular stage. Not only were squadrons rearming with different types of aircraft, but the trade structure was altering, and wireless operators were asked to make a choice then and there. Did they wish to remain as ground operators, or did they wish to become air operators? So I snatched the opportunity to return to my favourite job of air operating and volunteered. And literally overnight, I was moved. A most interesting experience in that I was on the watch from 6 o'clock at night until midnight. At 11 o'clock, the signals officer came along and said, "You are posted to Rizzlepur. I am now going to give you a test." He took me off the watch, gave me a viva voce test, asked a few questions, and at approximately 11:55, he said, "Right, it's too late to finish your watch. You have now been promoted to LAC. Your aircraft takes off at 5 o'clock in the morning. Be on the tarmac." And that is how I was posted to Rizzlepur.
Why did they have such a rapid change?
I'm afraid I can't answer that. I don't know. But not only myself, others were caught napping. And when I got to the tarmac at 5 o'clock in the morning, there were some of my comrades also waiting. And with our kit bags, we were flown to Rizzlepur, where I joined number 39 Squadron, which was just changing its aircraft from the Hawker Hart to the Blenheim 1. The Indian government had been coaxed by the British government into buying second-hand Blenheim 1s. And so the ones that the squadron was re-equipping had already got quite a large number of hours, but they were quite good serviceable aeroplanes. Within 3 days, we had recrewed the squadron. Pilots had selected their navigators. Navigators had selected the wireless operators, and so crews were formed. And a brand new 39 squadron was formed. On the same station was number 11 squadron, also similarly equipped with Blenheim 1s, also reformed. And we learned that the whole wing, that is the two squadrons, were to be moved to Singapore by way of reinforcements for Singapore Island. And so in June, not many days after I had arrived at Rizzlepur, we set off for Singapore as a squadron. Number 11 squadron had gone the day previously. The first leg from Rizzlepur was to Ambala, where all aircraft landed safely. Nine aircraft all landed safely. One rather excitable pilot, however, pulled the wrong lever, and instead of lifting his flaps, he lifted his undercarriage, leaving one aircraft on its belly. Since we were staying there for lunch, equipment officers apparently got together over their glass of sherry, and a new aircraft was found to replace this one. So 9 aircraft left for the next stop, which was Allahabad. We had been warned that the weather was going to deteriorate. Between Ambala and Allahabad, we struck very heavy rain and low cloud. And in fact, it was on this leg that my pilot told me he was using his undercarriage warning horn to notify crossing gatekeepers that we were coming. We were flying so low. That is his particular boast. But we were flying really low through bad weather. When we got to Allahabad, the airfield was literally underwater, and only one safe marked trap was available to us for landing. Once again, all aircraft landed safely. Yet again, the odd man out taxied off the safe track into the mud and turned over on his back. And pilot and navigator were almost drowned before they could be broken out of the cockpit. So, we stayed at Allahabad for two nights. The next leg, having made up the deficient aircraft with yet another replacement, next leg was to be to Calcutta from Allahabad. I was then flying in the third Vic of three. Two further Vics of three had gone on ahead, and we hit the most awful electric storm. Very heavy cloud, pouring with rain, and the aircraft, all three, were struck by one bolt of lightning. We could see it. We couldn't avoid it. Despite the fact that my radio was set on fire by the aerial being struck, I was able to see, on my left, the number two aircraft being flown by the wing commander was in flames, one engine burning badly. Number three aircraft on my right had disappeared completely. Anyway, I put the radio out with the aid of the fire extinguisher and my breakfast coffee. I said a flask, a beer flask full, but it was a breakfast coffee. Fortunately, I had not evacuated my bowels. I got back up to the Perspect Dome to look out, and I could still see the number two aircraft with the crew getting out. I saw one man leap out of the rear hatch, go down his parachute. The second man climbed out of the front cockpit onto the wing and made a swallow dive off the wing, and his parachute opened, and then the aircraft turned on its back and went into the ground. Crashed. We made our way safely to Calcutta and landed there. The third aircraft arrived about half an hour after we landed, and it was in such a condition that it was abandoned. That aircraft never flew again. Every rivet had been started. The luggage and spares had been torn from the bomb racks. The control column had been bent where the pilot had tried to right it from the spin. In fact, it was unserviceable. We stayed at Calcutta a further 2 days. Yet more replacement aircraft were found. So once again, nine aircraft left Calcutta on the next leg to Rangoon. The monsoons were still on us. The weather was still terrible, but we pressed on. En route to Rangoon, one aircraft got lost, landed in what it thought was a beautiful, lush, green field, which turned out to be a tin tailing, a lake where a tin mine had been, covered with blanket moss. Landed in the water, and the crew had to swim for their lives. Another aircraft ran out of fuel and landed on the beach, but was able to take off next day. That was all the casualties. The aircraft eventually reached Singapore. Only seven out of the nine. The trip itself took 13 days, when it should have taken three. But 39 Squadron arrived at Singapore.
What was Singapore like to be stationed there?
When we arrived in Singapore, we were at Tengah Airfield, a grass airfield. We were the first aircraft. The airfield had only just been opened. We were the first squadrons to occupy it. We only stayed there for a few days, and then we were moved to the civil airport. Again, an interesting experience in this move, in that both squadrons, 39 and 11, moved as a wing, 18 aircraft in formation. We got to the Kallang airport, landed in single file, but no aircraft completed the landing. It rolled across the aircraft, took off again, circled Singapore Island, and came back again. And we could only assume that this was kidology, that instead of 18 aircraft landing at Kallang, it was to kid the local people that 36 aircraft had landed. And at the civil airport, we were living in makeshift attap huts. These are rattan cane huts with banana leaf roofs. On banana leaf beds, using the civilian hangars for the aircraft, and maintaining a semi-military pose in that the civilian aircraft were still using the airport. And there we were when war was declared. Thoroughly enjoying life because Singapore Island has so much to offer socially. It has history, archaeology, and a wonderful climate. Whilst there, we flew exercises, shipping recognition exercises. We were taken over by the Navy by way of navigation training, and we were taught genuine sea navigation so that we wouldn't get lost. And this came into good effect later on.
What did they teach you about sea navigation?
How to find wind speed and direction by reading the wave tops, how to read the weather from the behavior of the sea and the clouds, how to take bearings on landmarks, and then how to identify shipping, tonnages, shapes, nationalities.
What's the significance of the wave tops?
Size, color, direction of rotation will tell you which way the currents are going, which way the wind is blowing. A lot of wave tops will tell you that the wind is above 10 knots, interspersed with green sea, probably 6 to 8 knots. This way you could get a good indication of wind speed and direction at sea level, which you would need if you're low flying, because wind speed and direction has a great deal of effect on flying.
You said earlier that you'd come across the Blenheim Mark I at Rusalpore. Had you seen Blenheims before at Drigger Road?
Yes, I had. Blenheims were being delivered to the squadrons in India. They were arriving from Egypt via Drigg Road and then being delivered. And as a wireless operator, I was again called upon to assist in these deliveries by acting as wireless operator on the delivery flights.
What type of impression did the Blenheim make on you when you first saw it?
Oh, a wonderful improvement on previous aircraft. I could see that this was something really new. It was faster, it was more comfortable to fly in, the equipment was better. Oh yes, a great improvement on Vickers Vincents and Wapitis.
What was the accommodation like for the wireless operator in the Blenheim?
The wireless operator was situated in a turret, a rotating turret. They were varying makes, some were Bristol, some were Fraser Nash. But it rotated through 360 degrees. It had good accommodation for the radio, in that it was boxed in units, easily changeable for spares. There was room for spare coils and equipment. It was heated, and you got a better view all around. You had a dome. You weren't at the mercy of the wind and the weather. But of course, you also carried a gun, which could be a nuisance.
In what way?
It took up rather a lot of room when you'd be wanting to look out. Also, of course, there was storage space taken up by the compartments for the ammunition. They were in boxes, large boxes. But again, as far as modernization was concerned, to me, at that time, this was the be-all and end-all of flying. It was perfection. I thoroughly enjoyed flying in the Blenheim. And later, when I transferred from... At Singapore, when I transferred from the wireless operator position and remustered as air observer, having concluded my training on navigation, I went to the front seat, and I enjoyed it even more, much more. Again, as I said, the squadrons were rearming, reforming. The Air Force structure was changing. It was not possible to bring out new observers from England, and so squadron personnel were chosen, given additional training on and with the squadron, and remustered on the spot. So I changed my wireless operator's badge for an observer's badge. Very pleasing, because the money increased at the same time.
Did the increased speed of the Blenheim affect your work as a wireless operator at all?
Not in any way at all. No, no.
As a wireless operator, you were also an air gunner.
Yeah.
Could you tell me about what it was like being an air gunner in those days with the equipment that you had?
Yes, the air gunner's responsibilities in the pre-war and early war days were similar to those later given to the air observer. He was responsible for the gun, that is, firing the gun and the maintenance of the gun. He was responsible for photography. He was responsible for assisting the pilot in navigation. And he was the bomb aimer. So, you couldn't say he did four jobs on a 25% basis each. Depend entirely upon the exercise of the day. He had to be able to fire at air targets. He had to be able to fire at ground targets. He had to be able to bomb from high level and low level. He had to be able to take photographs with the handheld camera obliquely, or he had to take vertical photographs with a fixed camera. And he had to assist with general navigation of the aircraft. So for this, he received 1 6 months a day extra, and he earned every penny.
What type of guns were you using at that time?
I was trained originally on the Lewis gun. We then improved and got a Browning, and that was in the Vickers Vincent. But on the Blenheim, we mainly used the Vickers gas-operated.
Tell me about the Vickers gas-operated and what it was like to use that.
The Vickers gas-operated gun fired about 600 rounds a minute. Its general operation was simple, and it was almost fault-free, something we couldn't say about the Browning or the Lewis. But it had one snag, in that the ammunition pans were worked by a spring. To fill the pan, one placed the bullets in one at a time and then wound the spring up as the bullets were placed in. You wound and we wound and you wound. So that by the time the last bullet was in, and I was trying to remember, I think there would be about 150 rounds in each pan, there was terrific pressure on this spring. And if one was careless, the spring came back and removed the knuckles. It was a very dangerous operation, loading the ammunition pans.
What do you mean, remove the knuckles?
Well,
scrape the knuckles.
Scrape the knuckles, it just took them straight off. But the gun itself, yes, was a great improvement on the Lewis and the Browning. And it later became the chief weapon on the Blenheim aircraft. We only had one gun, but later on they were fitted in pairs.
What were the problems with the Browning and the Lewis gun?
Stoppages due mainly to poor ammunition. It only needed one defective cartridge and you'd have half an hour's work to clear it.
Could you tell what was going to be a defective cartridge beforehand?
No, you couldn't, because it wasn't always yourself that loaded your magazines. If you loaded your magazines yourself, you could usually pick one out. But occasionally, I mean, you pick one up with a slight difference in charge, which would be internal, so you couldn't see that. Stoppages were in two kinds, number ones and number two stoppages. One where the breech block was still back, and two when the breech block was forward. There were different kinds of stoppages, and during the training you learn how to correct them. But to say, with the Vickers, we had very, very few. Only with very defective ammunition.
How accurate could you be?
Now, this would depend on several things. On air firing, for instance, you fired normally at a towed target. This would be a drogue towed behind another aircraft, and you would fly alongside the drogue and fire obliquely from the aircraft. 25% of hits was considered above average. Firing on the ground, you would have to rely entirely upon your pilot, because you would be telling him where to go, whether to go steeper, faster, to left or right. But there again, if you got 25% of your hits home, you were above average. Doesn't seem very economical, does it?
And you mentioned the photography.
Yeah.
What type of cameras were you using?
They were manufactured by a firm called Williamson's. The name had no particular name. We knew them as F-24 cameras. They would have varying size of lens. Normally, for the handheld camera, it would be a 5-inch lens. Battery operated or electrically operated, according to whether you were handheld or on the vertical. Rather heavy, cumbersome, produced a picture, 6-inch square picture. Vertical, your lens would vary from 5 to 20 inches, so you would photograph from varying heights. And you could use this for single pictures or for mosaics. We used them for targets, picking targets. Very interesting occupation, photography, especially from the Vincent aircraft, because you'll be standing up in your cockpit, leaning over the side, and you just wait for your target to come and then take the picture of it as it passed by. I did a lot of photography later on during the war in the Western Desert and over Crete, but that was all vertical photography on chosen targets, photographing airfields, shipping, garrisons, similar objects.
I think that you said that whilst you were on the Northwest Frontier, you were involved in being shot at.
Yes, this was a particular occasion when we were out getting the Blenheims ready for our trip to Singapore, and we perhaps flew too close to a sensitive village on the Afghanistan border. It was not a specific trip looking for trouble. We just happened to be in the area when a bunch of wild tribesmen let loose. And we came back with the Blenheim with a few holes in it. I think it was probably our own fault that we shouldn't have been there, or that we just happened to strike a bunch of rather excited tribesmen.
What did you think to the accuracy of their shooting?
Well, we didn't think it was accuracy of their shooting. We thought it was purely accidental, because some of these gentlemen were brought into the base later on with their weapons. And I shouldn't think any one of them was more modern than 1901. So they were firing, I should imagine, on the hosepipe principle, and we just happened to fly through it.
Were you involved in any bombing expeditions on the frontier?
No.
You mentioned earlier on the parachutes which you had. When did they come in?
We always had them, except in the flying classrooms, but in all the single-engined aircraft, we always carried our own parachutes. These were of two kinds. The pilots, or the, in the case of the Blenheims, the pilots and the observers, had a one-piece parachute, which meant the harness and the parachute were one, and you sat on the parachute, put the harness over yourself. As an air gunner, you wore the harness, which was attached to a pigtail in the aircraft, which attached you to the aircraft, but your parachute was carried separately in a holder. And should you need to evacuate the aircraft, you took your parachute off and hung it on the two hooks on the harness.
Did you feel confident in the parachute equipment?
Oh, yes. I had never seen a parachute fail. I've seen a number of people parachuting from aircraft. I have parachuted myself, but I've never seen a parachute fail. Oh, yes, we had complete confidence in them.
So there was never any question of, even in the early days, of aircrew being reluctant to wear parachutes?
No, I've never heard of any reluctance.
I think that whilst you were in Iraq, you took some rather interesting messages with the code letters NYD on.
Oh, that's quite true. From time to time, we would have to send signals to the Baghdad General Hospital, repeated to the hospitals in UK. And on this particular signal would be a name, a number, date of admission, and the magic words, NYD. Some time before we were able to find out exactly what NYD meant, except that we were told not yet diagnosed. After cajoling a medical orderly, we discovered it hinted that that particular person had been admitted to hospital for special treatment. Nowadays, you'll see posters in railway stations telling you where to go for this special treatment. It, of course, meant that this person was suspected of having venereal disease. NYD merely meant that he was under examination. It didn't always mean that he was suffering. And in Iraq, unfortunately, these signals were very frequent.
So, did the troops, did the airmen use brothels in Iraq?
Yes. Although, of course, there was treatment for them before they went out to the brothels. One booked out through the guardroom, and one was able to obtain what we call the ET packet, an early treatment packet which contained various items, from the common contraceptive to A hypodermic. In form, a hypodermic, not one one sees in emergency hospital, but merely a tube that one inserted in the correct place, and this was supposed to offer protection, but not always.